Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we're going to have an important show, one I'm looking forward to because this has been in my mind for a while now with the changes that have gone on in our education system. One of the things that's, I enjoyed school, I loved it. I was one of those people who loved going, loved learning, and I loved being challenged. And I feel like the education system is going the same way as our healthcare system. It's algorithm driven, it's keep your mouth closed, it's follow the train that's leading people off the cliff. And today we're going to speak with somebody who has been writing about this and who's lived it. And we're going to speak with Professor, he's actually Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He's the author of 11 books, the most recent being Thought Criminal and Beyond Woke. And today we're going to speak about his book called Google Archipelago, The Digital Gulag and the Simulation of Freedom, which he wrote in 2019. I think it's prophetic because it gave a really good rundown of where we find ourselves and where we're moving. And as our education system goes, I think that's how our society goes. And people have to be able to think outside the box. They have to be able to know who they are and stand in their truth and not just go along, get along. I think big data, the corporate consolidation of everything, whether it's healthcare, education, our freedom to choose and speak, is really on the line. Professor Rechtenwald has been a pundit, or is a pundit, and champion of free speech. And he opposes all forms of authoritarianism and totalitarianism, and they're coming fast and hard at us. He is the chief academic officer and co-founder of American Scholars, a pro-American education platform. In his prior career, he was professor of liberal studies and global liberal studies at NYU. And he's taught at Duke, at North Carolina Central University, Carnegie Mellon University. So I think he's well-versed in what the education system is and what it should be. So Dr. Rechtenwald, thank you so much for joining me. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
It's great to be here, Dr. George. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's get started because your book, Google Archipelago, I think is a real primer on how there's been a confluence between the big data, the government system, our social, you know, I would say not social justice, the last thing I want to say, but how social media has become really a fulcrum for control. How do you think this came about?
You know, I've traced the history of what I call big digital, or the major purveyors of digital technology and digital media, such as Google and Facebook and Twitter and all the other Apple and Amazon and so forth. And, you know, they started off as libertarians. They started off as freewheeling, open market, anti-competition, anti-monopolistic enterprises. But then they morphed into leftist authoritarian enterprises. They morphed into monopolies. And it took place over the course of about a decade or two after the, you know, takeoff of Silicon Valley. There was this move towards monopolization that happened once they got a corner on the internet and a corner on these technologies. They began to become authoritarian and monopolistic. They tried to close out and get rid of all competitors. They sought to demolish basically any kinds of opposition to their viewpoints, and they also became leftist overall. How that happened is really interesting and difficult to trace, but they are, and it's a very authoritarian form of leftism, so that they disallow, as we know, disallow opinions and disallow news, disallow perspective. They also disallow websites, and they ban and do all kinds of ranking that excludes other viewpoints, and they rank the news in such a way that we get particular perspectives on just about everything from everything you can name, from COVID-19 to education to the news, the politics, and so on and so forth. So we're dealing with a kind of monopolistic group that is also very much tied in with the state. They're like an extension of the state. They extend the state's power, reach, and penetration like nothing else. These are technologies that, you know, that dictators would have killed for, to put it more truthfully, and have the kind of power that is just unparalleled in history. So that's where we are. And we got there through this mutation of big digital into these monopolistic left authoritarian groups. Once they got there, they got theirs, so to speak. They then began to exclude others and using a particular ideology as a kind of litmus test to join the cartel and exclude others from it.
You know, I see this as an extension of politics as well. From a governmental standpoint and legislative standpoint, they have a lot of power. They can't really be touched. They have no liability. They get to do whatever they like. And so I can see that there's a would naturally be a connection between being the mouthpiece for someone in power who wants to stay in power, someone wants to gain it, and that anything goes. You know, we'll cut out your competition, but there's some. It's always a follow the money mantra in my mind. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money floating around in this. I don't think it's just because they have an ideology. Is there money that's also being made hand over fist?
There's money being made hand over fist. There's money being filtered into the political system. There are politicians effectively being bought off such that they are not liable for any kinds of adherence to the law, frankly. The Decency Communications Act, which was supposed to allow for internet freedom and creativity and innovation, has actually led to its opposite. And some of the money, frankly, is involved and comes from China. This Chinese connection should not be overlooked. There are tremendous interests and interlocking in financial interests between Chinese corporate and state functions and the functions of big digital. Google has contracts galore with Chinese companies who have contracts or are under the supervision of the state, the Chinese communist state, that is. So there's a lot that I think can be traced to this kind of influence, not just the buying off of the domestic politicians, but also this tremendous influence of the Chinese Communist Party on the digital community, on the big digital players. They see it as the biggest internet market that there exists, and they mean to continue to tap it. And there are many other connections too in pharmaceuticals with Chinese, but also American and British and other companies. So there's definitely money here. One of the things that they're aiming at is monopoly. So for monopoly to work, you have to get rid of competition. So one of the things that does is it pervades and favors a particular ideology, one that's against free market enterprise and favoring kind of like a corporate type socialism, as I call it. That is, they want to get rid of the free market and dominate the market through collusion with the state. And that's not just our own state, but other states. And get rid of competitors and likewise create a kind of a corporate socialist setup.
Well, let's explore that because I think that's the heart of everything and how our system and our society is moving towards. So let's take a break and revisit that when we come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. And he's the author of Digital Gulag and the Simulation of Freedom. And before the break, you were really getting into a very important, I think, nexus. And people need to understand exactly what you mean. You're a professor, so you're in the heart of all of this movement towards everything American is bad, capitalism is bad. It was almost like a mantra. I had no thought involved to it or with it. And the change in language from liberal versus conservative, I think most people would think the liberals are very easygoing, everybody, you know, live and let live, but that's not exactly what it's turned out to be. It is totalitarian. And liberalism is literally what they say that they're fighting against. They are, and they stand for cancel culture, wokeism. It's not about everybody being included. It's about people being put into little pockets that are designed to hate each other. So from how did the language get there? I mean, liberal used to mean liberal. It sure doesn't anymore.
Well, they started to adopt these certain precepts like diversity, equity, and inclusion, which to my way of thinking really signifies conformity, inequity, and exclusion. That is, it demands conformity with a particular ideological framework. It excludes those who do not abide by it, and it doesn't treat them as equal. It actually treats them as verboten, as less than equal, as actually utterly excluded and demoted to the lowest level, as deplorable, if you will. So it came about through a long institutional march in the academy. There's a long history. It dates all the way back to the 30s. And the infiltration of Marxist communist ideology through almost every department in the humanities and social sciences. And this became the framework through which they viewed everything in society. And then it mutated when the Soviet system failed and other communist regimes failed or proved to be totalitarian and oppressive beyond measure and murderous and so forth. They then switched the terms up into other categories, race categories, identity categories in general. And then they used the same sort of ranking and the same sort of antagonism to create a similar dialectic, if you will, between the the so-called privileged and the others. And they then aim to debunk the privileged and to use these other categories as a means by which to do it. But really, it was a Trojan horse, and it's always been a Trojan horse that really is Marxism in different costume, in a different Halloween costume as we approach Halloween, I shall say. It's a different look, but it's really the same ethos underlying. They use different terms. There are different categories that are being touted, but they really have the same ethos. And that is this kind of idea that the society is nothing but a battle of antagonism, that it's really framed in terms of, once was framed in terms of the working class versus the ruling class. Now it's framed in terms of the privileged and those that are not privileged. And so that the same kind of dialectical antagonism between these two partners is really their, these two antagonists, I should say, is really the ethos that underlies it. And that really has taken a complete grip on the academy and almost all subjects in the social sciences, humanities, and even into the sciences have now been inflected by this kind of framework. And this is just how people approach the world. They don't see that there could be other frameworks to look at the world through, that perhaps identity or what was once class are not really defining in terms of all defining in terms of how the world works. And it's very anti-individualistic. It's anti-individual. It's anti-free market. It's anti-personal autonomy. It doesn't agree with the idea that, you know, people have agency. Some people don't have agency in their terms. That is, they are not able, according to them, to do anything to improve their lives because of their position in social, the social position that they have based on race, class, gender, and so forth. So this is a very antagonistic worldview. It pervades the whole, it pervades the entire academic institutions and then has metastasized to the whole social body. It is now the kind of framework that's being used in corporate America, certainly big tech or big digital, and even the military, as we've seen. So it's been a long march through the institution, starting largely with the Frankfurt School in 1933, when they emigrated from Germany to the United States. Interestingly, these were Marxists who fled Nazi Germany, but they didn't go east to the USSR. Strangely, ironically, they ended up going west to their hated competitor, capitalism, in the United States. This is a curiosity that needs exploration. So that's basically how it happened and how we got to where we are on these terms.
That's an excellent synopsis. And, you know, I would, you know, piggyback on that. It's as if by separating everybody, they've made everybody their own captive, right? You're afraid to speak. You are cowed into submission because you don't want to stick your head up and get it lopped off by losing your job or losing your place on the team or on, you know, in a profession. And so we're gatekeeping ourselves. This is something that, is it a psychological connection? It's people don't like to be unliked. You know, they want to be liked. They want to be part of a group. But how do we lose our individual rugged individualism and merit? And, you know, for me, the whole Marxist setup, it's like garlic to vampires. When people are able to stand on their own, they're able to run their own lives, they take responsibility for what they do, and they use their talents, and they don't apologize for it. That's like, they can't stand that. They can't live. If people decide to withdraw their consent from this, it would collapse, wouldn't it?
Yes. I mean, they want to convince people that their prospects, their complete chance for success and so forth is all determined by their category, that it has nothing to do with them. So this is a way to guilt trip those who have achieved something and to also, I think, disempower those who are not, who disempower those in the groups that are told that they are utterly without agency, that their lives are all determined. They're determined by their category, by their social category. It's criminal in terms of how it disables people. And it's criminal in terms of how it makes people culpable for things that they have nothing to do with. So in that sense, it is very much against rugged individualism and the free market and self-determination. And it's all class or identity based. And so it's a real container that they put people in, that people can't escape, as you put it. They find it difficult to escape because you start to believe these things. And I know this because I was a leftist and I believed, you know, that my class position determined my future, things like that. And it's a self-fulfilling fatalism. It's a terrible self-fulfilling prophecy. And it is, we do end up becoming our own captors, as you put it. We erect the cage around ourselves, and this works into the favor of, actually, ironically, it works into the favor of these giant corporate monopolists, because they get rid of competition in advance. If you have people believing they can't achieve anything, they give up. And that's kind of what's going on.
That's a really good point. And if you look at all of the consolidation, and it's everywhere. It's not just media, it's academia, it's hospitals, it's doctors. You know, I'm a physician, so we've seen 90% solo practice doctors in small groups become, I think, 30% now, because they've all gone into the corporate healthcare system. And I think we're now living in, everybody is finding out that whatever the whip is that they're going to use against you, if you want to keep your job or you want to have, you know, a quality of life, then you're going to be beholden to it. And I think that goes on with professors, does it not? It goes on with everybody who's part of the system. It's like you're part of a grid. You'd better toe the line and keep that ball, you know, the juggling going, otherwise we'll get rid of you. But it just shows me that it's even more precarious. It is juggling. It's a house of cards. And as soon as people say, I'm not doing it, or they question it, if they're not, I mean, they're going to fire people, obviously. But I know that you've moved on to something that's a parallel system, and we're going to get into that in the next segment, an educational platform that people can have an alternate. I don't think this system is viable. And I'm more and more feeling that why play this game? Because it doesn't work and you will lose. But there's an alternate. You withdraw your consent and you create something of some that means something of substance. And right. those that get it will follow. And those that don't won't. And it'll be pretty obvious which one's going to win.
That's right. I believe that we need to erect parallel structures to these legacy institutions, which, as you put it, are corrupt to the core and completely infiltrated by this very pernicious set of ideologies that are ruining their output, that are actually putting people in debt while they are actually enslaving them mentally. It's a terrible consequence that it's having. And there is a way out, and that is to simply reject their claims to being the only source of education or what have you, and to create parallel structures.
I couldn't have said it better. I know that we're going to take a hard break in a minute, but I just want to echo that. We're now living in times where there's hard choices that have to be made. And I think it comes down to, what do you feel about yourself? Do you feel like you can't stand on your own? Do you feel like you're less than? And do you feel if you play the game, you're going to win? I mean, to me, it's every goalpost just keeps getting moved. Whatever people are acquiescing to, it's just never going to be enough. And there's going to be some other hurdle. And I wonder when people are going to say enough is enough, but hopefully that'll be the case. And I think if people see an alternative, they're more likely to choose it. So on that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you've probably noticed that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you're able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will likely continue to rise, while your healthcare choice and access will continue to fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We're committed to working with you. We specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductible or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. Call 404-591-9100 or visit us at PeachtreeENTCenter.com. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with the author of Digital Gulag, and people need to go to his website, michaelrechtenwald.com. And there you can find your writings, your blogs, and also can they get your books there?
Yes, my books. You can either buy them from me or buy them from Amazon. I naturally suggest you buy them directly. I have a warehouse full of them, and so I am able to distribute signed copies that way.
I like that. Stop feeding the beast and help people who are actually producing something. I feel like this. We're living in Ayn Rand or Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, you know?
Absolutely. Where people,
and that was, I came to it late, but I really get it now. And everybody has the choice. Everybody has a talent. I think that's what people really need to realize. It's not what someone superimposes on you. I'm so done with, you should think how we think you should think by the way you look or your accent or where you're from. It's so limiting and it's so racist and sexist.
Yes.
Just because you're a woman doesn't mean you have to do X, Y, and Z, or because you're Black, you need a leg up. No, you need to work hard. And if I failed at something, my dad said, you'd work harder. You know, this is how you do. You learn skills and you learn how to be resilient. I think that's being taken away, don't you?
Absolutely. And what goes with it, what else is lost, is individual freedom. What happens is you end up surrendering your rights, because when you don't have any right to self-determination, to create, to use your talents, to produce your own wealth, then you're actually a slave. And you become utterly dependent on the structures, And therefore, you lose individual autonomy and you lose individual freedom. And we see that happening as we speak in terms of the way that the country's been locked down by all the mandates. And no matter what you think about vaccines, the vaccine health pass, all of these things. And then there are other things coming that are going to be even more difficult to resist and more difficult to circumvent, like the use of algorithms to try to even control and predict our behavior, to sort of hem us in and to preclude free will by virtue of effectively instantiating itself and insinuating itself into our very consciousness vis-a-vis algorithms and so on and so forth, so that, you know, you'll basically be, your behavior will be determined by the structures. They will be determined by the technocrats. And that would be, for me, a nightmare. And I think for a lot of people who believe in freedom and individual self-determination would agree.
Well, you know, I was reading, you know, part of your book, and also one of the reviewers talked about a pentoptagon where you're constantly being surveilled. You're aware you're being surveilled and you change your behavior. It's again, it's you're actually being your own prison guard. They don't need you to do very much because you're doing it all for them. And stepping out of line or thought crimes and all these things that potentially come down the line. And let's tie this to the new technologies that are coming out. We've gone through all these variations of 3G, 4G, et cetera. Isn't 5G and 6G and so on and so forth bringing things like virtual reality into, like, it's merging them, right? So
yes,
it's not like you can turn off your computer and not be part of this anymore.
Yes, as I said at Google Archipelago, what's happening is that you are going to be in the internet, so to speak. You will not be on the internet. The internet as such will be ambient. It'll be everywhere, ubiquitous, and surrounding you. This is going to happen vis-a-vis the introduction of smart cities, which are coming to the United States as we speak. And of course, they're already operative in China. And these are total surveillance systems where your every move is known and predicted, in effect, through predictive algorithms. And if you do something, a false move, or even if they think you might be making a small false move based on these predictive algorithms, you could be preempted from acting. Smart city technology is like a total surveillance state where all of your actions are digitized and everything you do becomes a part of a vast database, including just walking down the street, whether you cross a street, how you walk, how long it takes to get somewhere, and on and on and on, and everybody you talk to. And, you know, this could be instituted vis-a-vis the health pass or the vaccine passport. It could be one of the means by which they the system introduces the social credit score, which is really how it's the means by which these smart cities control. Based on your social credit score, you can do this, that, and the other thing. Based on who you associate with, you get a certain score. So this is a complete thought and, you know, complete action and thought control. And to the extent that you'll know what's verboten, what's not allowed, and what is. And this will, as you put it about the panopticon, you'll preempt your own behaviors in advance. You'll actually become your own jailer. You'll become you'll become complicit in your own subjection.
You know, I've read when that first got rolling, the smart cities, that people were getting lower credit scores for things like jaywalking. I mean, it wasn't like you were committing crimes here. It was not paying your taxes, paying late, having debt. It was crossing the street and against the light. It was very, I wouldn't say arbitrary, but yeah, it was arbitrary. So it's like you just have to be a drone. No thought, no emotion, and that's how you get through with that type of environment. Did the people who are proponents of this, the people who are, and I think, you know, maybe I'm superimposing my thoughts on this, but I would think these are the same crowd who like global warming and everybody needs to not have children because there's too many of us on the planet. What do they understand about this? Do they understand that they're going to be prisoners in this system? Or do they think they're going to be free?
Well, I would first like to address how they're going to try to sell it to us, how they're going to appeal to us with this. And that is going to be, they're going to use like transhumanist ideology in order to appeal to us, that we'll be told these are all enhancements, or per Klaus Schwab in the fourth industrial revolution, that these are completely liberating technologies that will make life so much better, that will make all these possibilities come true, you know, including the possibility of life extension and so on and so forth, and access to the internet without going on the internet. In other words, you know, your brain will be connected to it, and you could then call up all this unlimited information. But there's the other direction that this information could flow, and that is from you to the databases, and from the databases to you, such that your very thoughts could be preempted and replaced. This is not, it sounds science fiction, but it's actually not, because these AI researchers are involved in this right now as we speak. They're working on these kinds of interfaces between the brain itself and the web, or the internet, or the cloud, or what have you. So now, whether they'll be trapped in it, they see themselves, they're very technocratic elitist, and so they see themselves as not really having to be subjected to what the masses are subjected to. These people, like at the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab and company, they think that they need to control our behavior in order to so-called save the planet and so on and so forth, for a fairer, greener future, as they call it. And then they sell this to us on the basis of some sorts of enhancements, but it really comes down to technocratic control over behavior and even thinking. This is very much on the table, and preempting behavior, as I said before. So I think they think themselves exempt in some sense, because they're the planners, and that they would benefit from the life enhancements and the life extensions, and even the prospect of living forever, as they would like to say in transhumanist thought, the idea, the prospect of overcoming death. This is very big on their agenda, while they're also interested in curbing population mobility, ownership of property for those in the majority.
Well, I've heard Mr. Schwab mention that, you know, you'll have nothing and you'll like it. That's their mentality. You're just, you know, useless eaters, and you're taking up space. But they don't, I mean, it's a fatal flaw with their whole argument, because if AI ever becomes sentient and omniscient in their view, they're going to be the same thing as we are. Do they not understand that? They're not special. I mean, it's going to be a system. It's made by man. Therefore, it is flawed. And to give it ultimate power is just ridiculous.
Yes, it could become AI totalitarianism, where the AI is actually controlling our behavior and all of behavior, the whole system, that it overtakes the decision-making processes that would otherwise be delegated to decision-makers, including state, corporate, and other decision-makers. So yes, This is one of the prospects, and there are very serious theorists who have looked into this question as to whether AI becomes actually a kind of totalitarian dictatorship over everybody, including those who think they are controlling it or introducing it. So yes, that's definitely a prospect. There is the other prospect that it just acts like a kind of advanced army on behalf of the ruling elite, that they are able to marshal it and control it to such an extent that they do exempt themselves from it. It's possible. Either way, it's possible. Either scenario could come to pass.
And they're both not good. Mm. On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Michael Rechtenwald. And again, his website is michaelrechtenwald.com. And before the break, I just, something came into my mind as you were talking about all of these iterations of control. I wonder if we're on that pathway now. We're living in a time where people are losing their jobs, and for healthcare, we're losing doctors and nurses. And there's been a big movement towards Watson and IBM and AI treating patients, running mm-hmm. algorithms. I wonder if this was their way of jumpstarting that, you know, just like self-driving trucks and cars. You know, the truckers, if they strike, they'll be gone and they'll have the system to work without humans being part of the military, the police force. I see a bigger picture somehow here.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, they're very straightforward about this. In his book, COVID-19, The Great Reset, Klaus Schwab says point blank that COVID-19 represents a great opportunity that should be seized upon in order to accelerate the Great Reset. And this Great Reset is this whole technocratic control of behavior, a limiting of consumption of fossil fuels, meats, mobility, and so on and so forth, which will be all inclusive. So you too can be part of the system of slavery. They use these terms, they're really euphemisms and covers for the precise opposite of what they say.
Exactly.
Everything is inverted. This is one of the things about totalitarian regimes and their language use. Basically, everything they say can be understood as being the opposite of what really it represents. So, yes, I think that, in fact, the prospect for that is quite real. And, you know, you mentioned algorithms and replacing medical professionals with algorithms to diagnose and prescribe. All that is on the table, and Google is very much involved in it. Google has been pushing for a total algorithmic medical care system for some time, and this is part of the Great Reset Fourth Industrial Revolution prospect. Yes.
I do remember years ago that they were trying to get patients' medical health information online.
Right.
And we fought that and it went away, but it seems like it's coming around again. You know, no matter what we do, whether you're a doctor, lawyer, whatever, you need teachers and you need to be educated in a way that helps people critically think. So, you know, you're the American Scholars platform that you're creating, I think is extremely important. People don't know how to learn. They don't know how to do their own research. They're looking it up on platforms that you just described, have edited out and canceled any alternate thought, and reality is basically gone. You're just co-signing what you thought, what you're being told at this point.
Right.
So tell me about how you started your American Scholars platform, because I love the fact that you're altering a different approach, not only for students, but for professors as well, right?
Yes, I decided that, you know, it wasn't enough to just criticize and analyze the problems and to complain about them and to, you know, endlessly critique it, that something had to be done. And after I left NYU, I started thinking that we needed to create parallel structures to these legacy institutions to give people an opportunity to actually learn without these pernicious ideologies indoctrinating them into these ways of thought that we talked about earlier. So I just so happened to run into two entrepreneurs who were involved in actually starting such a site, a big tech person who can't be named because he still works in big tech, and another entrepreneur from education. And we've teamed up and launched American Scholars as a alternative education platform that doesn't indoctrinate, that teaches things like American history, like we're going to launch all kinds of courses, but right now we have what we're calling the American Core, where we teach American history, the free market, its superiority over socialism and other planned economies, the principles of the founding, and then we're adding courses in all areas, including science, technology, the social sciences and so forth. So we're going to have a huge platform of courses where people can learn on their own. And we plan on offering certificates of completion so that you can take these courses and then prove competency and familiarity and expertise in various areas. And eventually, with the corrosion and corruption of these legacy institutions, these kinds of certificates, this evidence of your achievement may end up challenging, and we think it will, the degree programs that are being offered in the university systems, where everybody knows that it's now become nothing but a mill to make sure you can check off the right ideological boxes, that you have the correct perspective and you have the correct political thought, that you're politically correct, that you're towing the party line. So we think that this will eventually challenge these legacy institutions, maybe challenge them to the point where they have to clean up their act, but my guess is they'll double and triple down, because this is the way we've seen the left works. Rather than reforming, rather than having a renaissance, they seem to double down on their bad ideas. And, that's just that. And we'll do what we do, which is to create this parallel educational institution.
You just spoke a mouthful about how they're going to double and triple down. And I wonder if it's because they have another alternate source of income. It's not just the students paying their tuition. Government money is huge in that. Government money is huge in the healthcare system, in research. So they don't really get to feel any pain, so they think, when you withdraw your consent. But, I think there's a bigger picture. Having well-educated, informed citizens who can think for themselves, is kryptonite to them. They can do what they want to with whatever they've got, but they're not the movers and shakers. They will not create the people who understand the power of individual and being able to think outside the box. Those are the creators. They can't compete with that.
Right. And eventually, what they're doing is, they are trying, this is really capitalism or free market enterprise is how I'd like to call it, because the word capitalism was always an epithet from the beginning and used by Marx and others to denigrate the free market or free work and free exchange, which is really all it is. What they have is they're aiming at basically, they're banking on effectively socialism so that they don't have to compete. And they're trying to consolidate this socialist system. And this way, they're not in an open market. So you see this with corporations, with academia, with all these institutions. Why are they doing what they're doing? Why are they promoting socialism? Because they want it. They want it because socialism is a monopoly, if nothing else. It's a monopoly over everything by the state. And the state is going to be the one doling out the money. So that's where their bread is buttered, and that's why they're focusing on state money and not competition in a free and fair marketplace. So that's where we are today. But we have to challenge that with the market, with an open, free market of exchange. And having better products, having better ideas, this is what always drives innovation. Yes, this will collapse of its own weight because it will lack the innovation. It will lack the entrepreneurship. It will lack the creativity that keeps systems vital. And this is why socialism always collapses of its own weight. And so it will finally collapse. It's just the question of how long it will last, what kind of misery it will cause, and how much oppression we'll have to endure in the meanwhile.
Well, I think knowledge is power, though. If people are going along just oblivious to this happening and just getting the next update, iPhone and blah, 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 they're not helping themselves. And, I think from a medical perspective, we've seen that people are not happier. There's more depression, anxiety. Every time you engage with these platforms, people feel worse about themselves.
Yes.
So
They're not helping us either. They're also not helping us, because when they comply, this makes the system stronger. They become virtually agents of the state, and they become enforcers too. So those who go along to get along effectively become enrolled in the state apparatuses, and they create further state consolidation, which ends up becoming dominant over us more and more thanks to their complicity.
Well, before this locks down and it becomes hardwired like it is in China, what are the top few things you can think of that people can do now to put the brakes on this, to work against the system and to create their own?
Well, I've been talking about parallel structures and we talked about that. And what I've been doing is looking to, and I think this is just indicative of the condition we're in, I've been looking to the Soviet bloc, the former Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, and the dissidents who lived in those under those regimes and what they did, because I thought, well, I think we're past the point where we can just say, hey, what about the Constitution? It's obviously they have shredded this. They don't care about what these values are. So how did these dissidents survive? How did they overcome the system eventually? They formed these parallel structures, and these include not just educational, not just social, but economic systems. Economic structures, I should say, parallel economic structures, including creating communities of people of like mind, leaving cities, frankly, forming freedom cells, looking at alternative economic systems in terms of the currency involved. And that is very important, especially if a universal digital state-controlled currency comes into play where basically it's completely controlling your behavior. You need a way outside of that system, and that would be alternative currencies. So that's why I invest in Bitcoin and other alternative currencies. I'm not here to sell Bitcoin, but I make nothing out of Bitcoin except the fact that I'm invested in it. It goes back to these parallel structures. This is what they did in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. It's how they resisted and kept their sanity, survived, and eventually overthrew these oppressive regimes.
No, Professor Michael Recktenwald, it was really a pleasure speaking with you. Time goes way too fast, and I want to make sure people know how to get your book and find your writings.
Yes, to my website, michaelrecktenwald.com, and it's spelled RECTENWALD, one word, michaelrecktenwald.com. You'll find my books, essays, all my interviews, and this one will be there, and my other media appearances and photographs of my readers. I like to build a community myself. It's a parallel structure in its own. MichaelRecktenwald.com.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'd love for you to come back as you flesh out your American Scholars program. I want people to know, as it unfolds, how people can enroll and learn, because it's about knowledge. Ignorance is not bliss in this case. It's subjugation.
Exactly.
So thank you so much for joining me. I hope you have a blessed day.
My pleasure, Dr. George. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.